The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
That's all the announcements I have. Let's go ahead and turn over to Jude 11, Jude chapter 11, to begin the message today. Some of you might be thinking, Jude, again? Didn't we have a few sermons where we kind of went through Jude quite a bit? And we did. Last month, or maybe it's been a month and a half now, I can't recall, but I had given two sermons regarding a situation Jude and the Church of God during his time was facing. And Jude had made a comparison of some believers. Now, these were not entirely evil people, but they were some believers during his time. And he compared them to, in Jude 11, the way of Cain and the heir of Balaam. So Jude 11 says, "Woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, have run greedily in the heir of Balaam for profit, and perished in the rebellion of Korah." And so the first two messages that I had given about this subject discussed the reasons why Cain and Balaam were referenced. Now, in our examination of the scriptures about those men, we found that neither Cain nor Balaam were entirely wicked, as many people have presumptuously thought. Both of these men believed in God. Both of these men had a degree, anyway, of morality or ethics, if you want to put it into that category. The infamy of these individuals came from the fact that they were not entirely on board with God's expectations of for them and their behavior, therefore. And so they failed to accept what had to be done when overcoming certain obstacles in life, obstacles that you and I also face, such as lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, pride, and ego. So Cain, he was obedient to God in some ways. However, he allowed, as God encouraged him, sin lies at the door and its desire is over you, wants to take control of you. But Cain allowed sin at the door to take control of him instead. And we saw how it controlled his resentment, which grew into anger and even hostility toward his brother. But in his own mind, Cain was not entirely rejecting God. He didn't think that that was a complete rejection of God and his authority over his life. But we see that Cain polluted God's law. He polluted God's ethics. And that was evidenced at first, we saw, by the offering that Cain brought to God, but it was not accepted, unacceptable. He was bringing things that were second rate, not giving his best, perhaps not even giving God's required portion. So there's not a whole lot that's written in the Bible about Cain, but it is enough to understand the comparison that Jude had made to other individuals that were also believers in God. Cain had placed himself in a position of moral authority by choosing what he would do regarding God's law, how or if he would apply God's law entirely, and how he would respond to certain situations that he faced in life. And we all have that same choice, don't we? Cain lacked works of faith, just like the people that Jude wrote about. It was a failure to submit entirely to God, and it was directly related to this thing that just about everybody faces, an obstacle: pride, ego. And these are the same factors that led the ungodly men that Jude wrote about. Now, I call them ungodly because, not because they did not believe in God, but because they were not entirely godly in their attitude, in their behavior. When studying the heir of Balaam, we saw that Balaam also believed in God. He was not an Israelite by birth, but he did believe in the God of Israel. In fact, we saw that God had several intimate conversations with Balaam. And that can't be said about a lot of people that are believers in God. However, the error Jude spoke of is not defined as a mistake. We examined that word, error, of Balaam. And the definition of the word that is translated as error means fraudulence. It means something that is done in deceit or to deceive. So Balaam's failure to obey God was intentional, but it did not start out that way. Balaam had a measure of respect for God's authority. We saw that he would not boldly disregard God's instruction to not put place a curse on Israel, that God was blessing them. He was with them, and so he would not do that openly or boldly. But over time, we saw that Balaam weakened. He gave in to his desire of a lust for the flesh. He gave in to the temptation of money, wealth, prestige among the people of Moab. And he then was instrumental in moving Israel away from God's instruction to not marry among the pagan people of Moab. And he instead encouraged it, and he told them, here's how you can cause them to stumble. So the self-serving attitude that Balaam had was similar to those that Jude spoke of. People that also believed in God, but they did not believe everything that the apostles taught about God, those things that were all accurate. And so they thought that they should be the ones teaching. We're going to teach our own thing about God. Now, the last comparison that Jude made in Jude 11 is the infamous end-of-life efforts of Korah. And Jude called it a rebellion. And like the first two individuals that we studied, in order to thoroughly understand why Jude made this reference to Korah, we need to read the historical record about Korah. So let's go back, therefore, to Numbers, the book of Numbers. Numbers in chapter 16. Now, many of us are familiar with the account, but another review of the Bible, of course, never hurt anyone. It can only be helpful. Korah, he was the son of an individual by the name of Yitzhar, who was a Levite. And Korah was first mentioned actually way back early on in the book of Exodus, Exodus chapter 6, I believe. And likely he was mentioned early on because of the significance of his story. So it's something that we should also consider the example there, or perhaps you could call it the bad example. So Korah, he was a Levite, and he was not a descendant of Aaron, so therefore he was not eligible to become a priest of the tabernacle, also known as a temple priest. Nonetheless, being a Levite that had the care of the tabernacle itself, the maintenance of its furniture and the functions of the tabernacle, this is no small thing. And so being able to serve God, of course, in any manner is a great honor to anyone. The situation with Korah begins after Israel had departed from Sinai. They had journeyed to the borders of Canaan, and they were instructed to send spies into the land and for the spies to bring back a report of those things that they had saw in the land that God was sending them into. And as we know, the report brought back by the spies was not well received by the people of Israel. Some of the accounts that were told to the nation of Israel were actually exaggerated. And so the people were afraid. They did not want to go into the land. They didn't want to go forward with God's plan. Only a few individuals remained faithful at that time. And not long after that event, those individuals that were striving to remain faithful to God, they had their lives threatened by almost all of the people of Israel. So some weeks later after this, or perhaps some months later, there was another uprising that began to stir. A cadre of men that were gathered together under the leadership of this son of Yitzhar, Korah. So number 16, we're going to read the entire chapter, but I'm just going to read a portion at a time. Number 16 in the first verse says that Korah was the son of Yitzhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben. They took men And they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown, in other words, people that were well respected among the tribes. And they gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Eternal is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the assembly of the Eternal?" So we first notice there are several accusations that are made here against Moses and Aaron, and we see that these accusations are vastly false accusations. Korah and his followers claimed that Moses and Aaron had put themselves into these offices of being, you know, some of the big decision makers, having oversight over the tribes of Israel. But that is not accurate. They did not choose to be in these positions. It was God who chose Moses and then chose Aaron to be the high priest of the tabernacle. So fulfilling a responsibility before God in this way, it wasn't Moses' choice. It wasn't Aaron's choice. It wasn't self-exaltation. This was a duty, a responsibility before God. And in fact, when we read the account of Moses when he was first called by God, he didn't want it. He asked God, "Pick somebody else at the burning bush. Pick someone else." And he said this on more than one occasion, causing God to get a little bit angered about this. "Look, Moses, you're going. You're going to do this, and I will be with you." But of course, we know the story that he sent Aaron along to be a support for Moses, and Aaron eventually was instrumental in bringing the Israelites out of Egypt. And so it was also claimed by Korah in these accusations here that the responsibilities of Moses and Aaron, that they should be shared among the people or among the congregation, certain leaders in any way. He said, "You take too much upon yourselves," meaning you have too much to say about what is done, about what shouldn't be done, about how things should be handled among the people. So a question that I, having time to reflect upon this conversation that these individuals had here, a question that came to my mind while considering this situation is, you know, asking the insurgents here, why the complaint? I mean, what is really the problem here? What makes you so unhappy about this situation right here? Well, the obvious answer would be that Korah and many others, they didn't like the rules. We don't like the rules of the game here. Or perhaps they don't like the consequences for violating the rules. So they likely felt, well, you know, if we could be in charge, we can change the rules. We can make things a little easier on ourselves and on the people. Now, keep in mind, again, these are people who believed in God. They understood God is the God of the world. They considered themselves actually to be holy. They considered themselves to be just as righteous as Moses and Aaron. Now, assuming that were true, the conclusion was that they were just as deserving to be ministers for God to the people as Moses and Aaron. And a response to that comes to mind from a good friend who is deceased. He's sleeping right now, waiting for a resurrection. Deserving has nothing to do with it. It really doesn't. Moses wasn't deserving to be called by God. God chose him for a reason. God had worked with him throughout his life for this purpose, to be a type of Savior to the people. And so deserving is not up to us to decide. It's something for God to decide. As it says in Isaiah 46, "I am God, there is no other. I am God, there is none else, nobody like him, declaring the end from the beginning and from ancient times, the things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure." Not your pleasure, Korah. Not your pleasure, Moses. I know what's right and what's best for everybody involved. And God says he's going to do it his way. So the point that is obvious, but intentionally, I think it should be obvious anyway, but it's intentionally, I believe, overlooked by Korah and his men, is the fact that the responsibility that came with the offices that were held by Moses and Aaron, these were not up for debate. These were not up for redistribution. Now, there are some tasks that could be allocated to other individuals, and we heard about that earlier in the story, where Jethro came down to meet with Moses, and he gave him some sound, godly advice about, you know, distributing some of this workload to some of the people who have the ability to share some of this work. People that have the Spirit of God, people that are led by God's Spirit, people that can help make decisions in some such matters. And then those ones that are too difficult, have them bring those matters to you and Aaron, and then you decide. And so, not all tasks, though. This doesn't mean that everything could be shared or distributed among the people. This was not a decision that Moses or Aaron could make, so they couldn't, you know, they couldn't go to Moses and say, hey, Moses, here's what you need to do. And Moses is going to say, you know, that sounds pretty good. I'm going to do that. This wasn't up to Moses or Aaron to decide. It was already decided. It was ordained, in fact, by God. And even if Moses wanted to, it wasn't his call. He couldn't do it. So Moses knew this, which is why it says, as he continued, he responds here in verses 4 and 5, when Moses heard these words of Korah and his men, it says he fell on his face. Now, obviously, this is not talking about him literally just falling down on the ground onto his face. I think it's more like this. He's like grieved at what's going on because Moses knows what's really happening here, and Moses understood what the result could be. Not good for these people. Not good for many people. And it's also likely, I think, that Moses may have just bowed his head and started talking to God about this. And I think that's evident when he responded now. It says in verse 5, he spoke to Korah and all his company, saying, tomorrow morning the Eternal will show who is his and who is holy, and will cause him to come near to him, that one whom he chooses, he will cause to come near to him. And so it is, we see Moses pausing here, likely to be able to understand exactly what should be said, how he should respond to this, being inspired by God, probably asking God, how do you want me to handle this? And it resulted, therefore, in the following instructions in the next few verses. Verse 6, do this, talking to Korah and his men. Take censers, Korah, and all your company. Put fire in them and put incense in them before the Eternal tomorrow, and it shall be that the man whom the Eternal chooses is the Holy One. And then he adds, you take too much upon yourselves, you sons of Levi. In other words, he's saying, you're gone too far. You've really taken it a step too far. This should have been, maybe gave those guys some chills. Gives me chills thinking about doing something like that to God, somebody who God has called to use. So they were the individuals that were being presumptuous, not Moses and Aaron. It was Korah and his men who had taken too much upon themselves, trying to usurp the authority that God had given these individuals. And it continues to say in verse 8, then Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi. Is it a small thing? He's talking to specifically to the tribe of Levi here, those people among Korah's insurgency that would have been of the tribe of Levi. Is it a small thing to you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the work of the tabernacle of the Eternal, and to stand before the congregation to serve him? So that is a great honor. Is that honor so insignificant that you feel like you need more? You need something else? And that he has brought you near to himself, you and all your brethren, the sons of Levi, with you. And are you seeking the priesthood also? Therefore, you and all your company are gathered together against the Eternal. And what is Aaron that you complain against him? So Moses and Aaron were men. Some people would like to say they were merely men. That's true. That is accurate. Who were they that Korah was complaining about them to them? Well, even though they were men, they were individuals that God chose to use in a remarkable way. And so the reality of the situation was that the rebellion was not against Aaron. Who is he that you're speaking out against him? Moses said it plainly. You are coming up against the Eternal. You and all your company are gathered against God. So perhaps Korah and others that were with him, they didn't see it this way. They believed in God. They had a degree of morality. They kept the commandments to a degree. Obviously, breaking several of them right here in this insurgency. But they didn't see it that way, but that's how God saw it. And God's perspective would be made known to everyone by making an example of the insurgents. As the story continues in the next several verses, verse 12, and Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, but they said, "We will not come up." Ooh. Rebellion. Is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of a land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness? As if this is Moses' fault. Taking the blame on themselves because they did not do as God had instructed. That you should keep acting like a prince over us? Moreover, you have not brought us into a land flowing with milk and honey, nor given us inheritance of fields and vineyards. Will you put out the eyes of these men? We will not come up. And I think this is probably as saying, will you put out the eyes of these men? Not saying, are you going to just torture them? You're going to, right here, are you going to take out a sword and start hacking away? No. I think he's saying, are you going to destroy their vision of new leadership? Because they have a vision of others being in charge. You're going to put that out of their eyes? Moses was very angry after hearing this in verse 15, and said to the Eternal, do not respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey from them, nor have I hurt one of them. So Moses was angry about this situation, and really, you think he's rightfully angry about what's going on here. He didn't seek honor. He didn't seek reward from the people of Israel. He was not trying to get rich through his service to God and for the people. He was trying to establish Israel as a strong nation that would live faithfully under God's rule. And in return, we see him now being blamed for the failures of the people. Their failures was being blamed on him before trying to enforce God's law among them. So the rebels believed that new leadership could begin to solve their problems. And of course, when they began pointing the finger at Moses and Aaron, we all know what happens when you start pointing the finger at people. We've all probably heard this, right? Who am I pointing at? There's two fingers, right? Technically two fingers pointing at you, but look at these ones over here. Three more pointing right back at me. So they're trying to point at Moses and Aaron, and Moses is saying, you should probably look somewhere else to blame for your failures. And so we're going to read several verses now going forward in verse 16 as we continue the story. And Moses said to Korah, tomorrow you and all your company be present before the Eternal, you and they, as well as Aaron, and let each take his censer and put incense in it, and each of you bring his censer before the Eternal, 250 censers, both you and Aaron, each with his censer. And if you don't know what a censer is, it's basically just like a metal, probably brass plate or a cup, something that can hold hot coals. And you could put some incense in there as well, so the incense would burn and be fragrant. And so in verse 18, so every man took his censer, put fire in it, laid incense on it, and stood at the door of the tabernacle of meeting with Moses and Aaron. And Korah gathered all the congregation against them at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Then the glory of the Eternal appeared to all the congregation. And what that exactly looked like, we don't know, but it was glorious, and that's the only way to describe it. Could have been a mixture of fire and cloud, or, you know, light, something going on. Obviously, something supernatural. So everybody knows that's God. That's active at this point. And the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, in verse 21, "Separate yourselves from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." So God said, here's how I'm going to deal with it. But Moses and Aaron, they fell on their faces and said, again, I think in deep concern and talking to God and saying, "No, O God, the God of the spirits of all flesh, shall one man sin and you be angry with all the congregation?" So Moses, he didn't know the extent of God's wrath that was going to be unleashed here. He, you know, God said among the congregation, it could have been everyone. You know, Moses, God had told Moses before, he said, "I'll make a holy nation out of you, Moses. I'll get rid of everybody else, and I'll take you and use you to make a nation of my people." And Moses, on behalf of Israel, said, "No, God, don't do this. Don't do this." And God listened to Moses. So the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, verse 23, now we go to verse 24, "Speak to the congregation, saying, get away from the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram." And then Moses rose and went to Dathan and Abiram, and the elders of Israel followed him. And he spoke to the congregation, saying, "Depart now from the tents of these wicked men. Touch nothing of theirs, lest you be consumed in all their sins." And so they got away from around the tents of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. And Dathan and Abiram came out and stood at the door of their tents with their wives, their sons, and their little children. And Moses said, "By this you shall know that the Eternal has sent me to do all these works, for I have not done them of my own will." I'm not doing what I want here, guys. I'm doing what God is telling me to do. And then he goes on to say, "If these men die naturally, like all men," in other words, a natural means of death, "or if they are visited by the common fate of all men, then the Eternal has not sent me. But if the Eternal creates a new thing, and the earth opens its mouth and swallows them up with all that belongs to them, and they go down alive into the pit, then you will understand that these men have rejected the Eternal." Now it came to pass, as he finished speaking all these words, very quickly here, and as we say, if sentence is not executed speedily, what? The hearts of men are set to do evil. And what do we see happening in this country and around the world today? Crime running rampant because the sentence of individuals is not executed speedily, sometimes not executed at all. But just as he finished speaking here, it came to pass as he finished speaking all these words that the ground split apart under them, and the earth opened its mouth and swallowed them up with their households and all the men with Korah, with all their goods, so that they and all those with them went down alive into the pit, and the earth closed over them, and they perished from among the assembly. That must have been a shocking, traumatic thing to see, much less experience. Those individuals went down. I don't think they probably died very quickly from suffocation or being crushed. But then all Israel who were around them fled at their cry, for they said, "Lest the earth swallow us up also." And a fire came out from the Eternal and consumed the 250 men who were offering incense. So those individuals were picked out to be an example, but the rest of the people that were a part of the insurgency, were not spared. And the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "Tell Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, to pick up the censers out of the blaze, for they are holy, and scatter the fire some distance away." So those, you know, the coals that were in the censers and the incense that may have still been burning, go dump that somewhere else because it was not an acceptable offering, according to God. But we're going to use these instruments for something. "The censers of these men who sinned against their own souls, let them be made into hammered plates as a covering for the altar, because they presented them before the Eternal, and therefore they are holy, and they shall be a sign to the children of Israel." So Eleazar the priest took the bronze censers which those who were, had burned up had presented, those who were burned up had presented, and they were hammered out as a covering on the altar to be a memorial to the children of Israel, that no outsider who is not a descendant of Aaron should come near to offer incense before the Eternal, that he might not become like Korah and his companions, just as the Eternal had said to him through Moses. So these censers were hammered, perhaps heated up, hammered. They were used as a covering for the altar of burnt offering. That's the altar that's being spoken of here. And the reason God chose to use the altar of burnt offering is because this is something that was able to be seen by people. Remember, the tabernacle had these walls that were made out of material that was somewhat transparent so that you could see into the court and you could see what was going on inside the court. Now, you couldn't see inside the holy place where the altar of incense was and the table of showbread, and, of course, the Ark of the Covenant was in the holiest of all. But you could see into the courtyard. If you came to present an offering, you could see what was done with that offering. And so people could see that altar there, and they would be able to see those plates from those receptacles or their censers that were hammered and used to cover the offering. And that would be a constant reminder of them, of what happened to Korah and his men. So the conclusion is that it would be presumptuous and very dangerous, in fact, for those that who are not called, those people who are not ordained, to assume positions of authority over others without going through the proper channels. That is the lesson from the rebellion of Korah. And this must have been a shocking, a terrible thing to witness. People were screaming and running away, afraid for their own lives. Now, we don't know exactly. We kind of picture, you know, an earthquake where the ground splits open and maybe they fell down into it. It could be that there was some kind of, like, quicksand involved where it opened up and they were just kind of sucked down into the earth. But regardless of how it played out, it was obviously something that was miraculous. There was some supernatural involvement there. It definitely came from God. And as shocking as it may have been for many people to see, not everybody was shocked by this. Not everybody was afraid for their own lives. And not everybody was, therefore, cautious about continuing such an insurgency against people God had called to be his ministers unto the tribes. And, of course, likely, if you think about it, the logistics of this, the reason probably is because not everybody would have seen this. Now, it would have been seen by many people, but not everybody. I mean, look, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of people that are encamped in an area. We're talking about three households or three, you know, encampments of three individuals. And the areas where they were camped, that opened up and they went down. A lot of people would have seen it, but not everybody. Word of mouth travels fast, especially in such a small group, and it would have gotten around what exactly had happened. But not seeing it for yourself, perhaps some people were not entirely convinced. Did this actually happen? Or even if it did, maybe it's exaggerated. I mean, look at, they exaggerated about the spies that went into the land of Canaan. Many of those spies exaggerated. And so it becomes clear that the message God had sent by taking swift action against these individuals, and of course there's the 250 others that were consumed. Many people would have saw that, but not everyone would have witnessed it. But God's swift action was not well received by everybody. As shocking as it would have been, not everybody was convinced that Korah was wrong. Korah and his men were wrong. And we see that as we continue in verse 41. On the next day, all the congregation of the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Eternal." So they didn't believe this was God's. It's your fault. You did this. And it happened when the congregation had gathered against Moses and Aaron that they turned toward the tabernacle of meeting, and suddenly the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Eternal appeared. Again, another sentence is going to be executed speedily. Then Moses and Aaron came before the tabernacle of meeting, and the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "Get away from among this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And they fell on their faces. Again, don't do this, God. So Moses said to Aaron, take a censer, put fire in it from the altar, put incense on it. And so Aaron, obviously high priest, was allowed to do this. He was supposed to be, him and his sons were the only ones to be these temple priests to carry out such duties. Take it from, take it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them. For wrath has gone out from the Eternal. The plague has begun. And then Aaron took it as Moses commanded and ran into the midst of the assembly. And already the plague had begun among the people. And so he put in the incense and made atonement for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living. And so the plague was stopped. Again, I think this was another example. God orchestrated this, showing, look, here is an individual I chose to be a type of mediator between you and me. Aaron. Aaron and his sons, they shall be the priests. Now those who died in the plague, verse 49, were 14,700, besides those who died in the Korah incident. So you can do the numbers there. It's, you know, close to 15,000 individuals. And so Aaron returned to Moses at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, for the plague had stopped. Now this was an extremely hard lesson for the people of Israel to learn, but it is an enduring lesson. It was documented so that we would have this continually. It was reminded by Jude, reminded us of this incident, because it is an important lesson that should still resonate with the people of God today. Now, consider again Jude's accusation. I'm not going to go back and go through the first verses of Jude like we did during that first sermon. We went through that very thoroughly and examined what was going on there. But the situation, in summary, the situation Jude was writing about, it had to do with certain people that were taking something that was clean, such as God's doctrine, such as God's structure of church government, and they were presumptuously placing themselves into positions of authority to teach what they felt should be taught, what they felt was correct. So they weren't going through the proper channels here. They did not have elders, or at that time apostles, and there were also elders that were involved in the church. They didn't want any of those people involved with their efforts. They didn't allow in this way for their errors to be noted and therefore corrected, saying, look, you can't do that, and here's why. This caused them to lead people astray. People were being led astray in the church because of those individuals. Now, simply because this is a case, we have to note that just because an individual is ordained, it doesn't mean they're right about everything. It's definitely something to be noted and considered, but it doesn't mean that they are right about everything that they might believe or teach. However, the responsibility that comes through God's government, He designed church government, it carries with it a deep sense of regard and caution that those individuals that are ordained in positions of authority have to act cautiously, reverently, go over it again and again and again, and make sure this is right before you put it out there and you begin to teach people about the Bible. And so, for this reason, James wrote this in James 3, and you don't have to turn there. I should add you turn there, but it's just one verse. It's the first verse of James chapter 3, where he said, my brethren, let not many of you become teachers, knowing that we shall receive the stricter judgment. Now, this is not a sermon, an attempt to elevate ministers above other people. It's simply something that God has designed and we need to be aware of, because it is happening today. It has been happening ever since the time of Korah. Today, it is happening in many of the churches of God, or among, I should say, many of the brethren of the churches of God. Those who have not gone through the proper channels that were dictated by Christ, that were carried out by the apostles as our example, those people who assume the duties or the responsibilities of a minister, they don't have the pressure that ordained individuals are to have. The offices of authority and instruction are to carry with them extreme caution and care. And I see a lot of people out there doing their own thing, and frankly, they are being careless. Not that they don't care about what they think and what they believe, but perhaps you could say they're being reckless in what they're doing. So ministers are not to teach anything without being sure it is accurate. Now, there, of course, is some speculation that is allowed. We can speculate. I'm allowed to speculate. It has to be noted that this is speculation. I might offer some, you know, evidence. Here's why I think the speculation might be accurate. And sometimes maybe it is, sometimes maybe it's not. But I'm noting, hey, I'm just speculating here about this. That is allowed. But those who assume such authority without going those channels, through those proper channels, they are, as James said in chapter 3 and verse 1, they are going to be judged just as strictly as those individuals who have been ordained to teach. So you want to take that responsibility on. You're going to take on the judgment too. And so the carelessness needs to be considered. And of course, it's compared, Jude compared it to the rebellion of Korah. This is Jude's comparison. An elder of the New Testament church, as established by God, by Christ at that time. And I think he was accurate. Let's go to Ezekiel 34. Ezekiel 34. I have seen not just a few, but I have seen several, perhaps many, lay members take ministerial responsibilities upon themselves. They will disregard the attentive respect for the office. I have seen them openly insult the ministry, speaking very badly of those people who are ordained in positions in the church. I have seen them lead people astray, teaching things that are not right. And even if those people who do such things do not cause others to stumble, maybe they just teach exactly the same thing as the many other elders in the Church of God teach. The caution against such presumption was recorded in the Bible. Aren't we to listen to every word of God? Aren't we to consider everything that God has to say? Or just do we want to consider just some of those things? I'm just going to pick and choose what I want to consider. Or should we consider everything? We have to consider everything. We can't take some and leave some. We can't pick and choose which commandments we want to keep. God says you have to keep all of them. He even says if you break one, you break them all. Because once you break one, you're breaking the first one, which automatically breaks all of them. And so it is that this was recorded as an enduring lesson for us. Now, Jude, he called those people dreamers. I don't know if you remember, some of you were there when I gave that message. He referred to those people as dreamers. And that expression refers to individuals that claim to have visions, claim to hear voices, or frankly, just people that claim that God is inspiring me to teach. He wants me to lead other people. And I've heard people say that God told me. And I'm like, did he really? Or is it just that's how you interpreted something you read? There are dozens of people out there among the scattered churches of God that have become what they call independent from the Church of God. I still don't quite grasp that concept of being independent from the Church of God. I think aren't we supposed to be a part of the Church of God? I know they might explain it differently, but I've seen these people. They might have their own Sabbath services. Some of them host their own Holy Day sites. Many of them have their own websites, or perhaps they have their own media pages on Facebook or some other social media platform. There are some of these groups that presumptuously accept tithes and offerings, and they think that it's their right to do so. And they attempt to justify it, claiming that, well, God is inspiring me. God is working with me. I've heard them say things like this. But there's a reason. See, there's a reason God chose to have a hierarchical government in his church. And the reason is what? It should be obvious. God's government is hierarchical. The kingdom of heaven that exists right now is a hierarchical government. God is above all. And there's 24 elders. There's the four living creatures. There are angels, some that are in a higher office than others, called archangels or cherubs or seraphim. And so we see the example of heaven is to be reflected, therefore, in the church. Now, most would agree with that. Most would agree, oh, yeah, God's government is hierarchical, but I have seen people in the church say, well, hierarchical government among men is evil. Well, then why did God tell us to work like that? I mean, I understand what they might be saying is that some people in hierarchical government abuse their positions. Sadly, there has been abuse of certain offices in the world and even in the Church of God. There have been some ordained who have abused their position. And so therefore, there has been a valid reason on occasion to not listen to what a minister might tell us to do. On occasion, that's something we have to note. On occasion, there have been some things that have been taught in the Church of God that were not accurate. There are some things that are taught by some ministers today that are not biblically sound. And those things we don't have to follow. We shouldn't follow. But some people have taken some of these occasional instances and applied it across the board. And they're like, well, we just can't trust any of the ministry. We can't trust anybody that's an elder. I even spoke to one individual one time in a group, I think it was in Montana even, that said, we don't have elders here. In other words, we don't want elders to be a part of this, what we're doing. Who's going to answer? Who's going to answer for when things start going off track? Is it everybody just does what's right in their own eyes? That's not what God has designed the church to be like. And that, therefore, is the rebellion of Korah. And so I want to review some of what we learned about Korah's example. There were accusations that were made by Korah and his followers, claiming that Moses and Aaron elevated themselves to an office of authority. We saw that was not true, that fulfilling an obligation or a duty before God, this is not elevating the self. It's doing what they are responsible for. So it's a duty before God. And this same kind of accusation has been made by some against ministers in the Church of God today. Now, in a handful of cases, there were legitimate complaints. And there might be legitimate complaints at times because of some overstep of authority. I mean, I think ministers are to teach doctrine. They're not to micromanage people's lives, tell them what kind of car they should buy or what kind of toilet paper they should use. That's not the responsibility of an elder. They're there to teach doctrine and to try to help keep us on track. However, because there have been some mistakes, some abuses, people out there, some people have applied them across the board. And hundreds, I believe it's probably hundreds of individuals among the scattered churches of God have assumed the office of a minister without going through the proper channels. And they're leading people, many times leading people astray. And that is the rebellion of Korah. It was claimed that the responsibilities of Moses and Aaron should be shared among the congregation. The specific words were, you take too much upon yourselves, Moses and Aaron. And this was because, as we see, what it boils down to is the people, they either didn't like the rules or they didn't like the consequences for them breaking the rules. Now keep in mind, again, these were people who believed in God. These were people who had a degree of respect for God. Maybe not as high as they should have. And we see this happening today. It's continuing to happen unto this day. There are certain tasks that can be assigned, they can be allocated to others in the church, but we see that a deacon cannot assume the responsibilities of an elder. And we see that lay members, they cannot consider themselves to be a deacon without going through the proper channels. There are many people in the church that help quite a bit. And frankly, they are doing deacon work without the ordination. Some people don't want to be ordained. Maybe it's because they don't want the responsibility that comes with ordination, but it's not for me to say. But there are certain things that can be handed out, allocated, just like, you know, with Moses, allocating certain duties to others among the people of Israel. But there are certain some things that cannot, that there has to be an authority involved. And of course, that authority and the ordination comes directly from God. And so God chose to have it this way. And he said later the reason for it, when before the people of Israel went into the promised land, nearly 40 years later, he told them, I don't want everybody doing what they are doing here today. Everybody doing what's right in their own eyes. You know, we don't get to decide how we are going to apply God's law. That's spelled out for us in the scriptures. The only thing we get to decide is if we are going to apply God's law. So there are offices in the church that are not up for debate. They're not up for redistribution. If Moses wanted to distribute his duties, he was limited in what he could give others to do. It wasn't his call. Now, some might try to argue this. It was brought up a while back. Somebody might try to argue that, well, unlike most elders in the church today, all elders, as far as I know of, Moses and prophets of old were not ordained by the hands of men. And they try to use that as a justification to say, I'll just make myself a minister or a prophet. I'll be a prophet because prophets of old were not ordained by men. Well, that's wrong. And the reason is this. These individuals in the Bible that were not did not have hands laid on them by men, which many of them did, but they did not all, they were called by God. Okay? God spoke to them. God gave them visions. God sent an angel to talk to these individuals. That is ordination at its best. The highest form of ordination is God speaking to you from a burning bush saying, I'm calling you to do this, and here's what you need to do. I would call that ordination. So people can't use that as an excuse to say, well, I'm just going to be a minister. I'm going to be a prophet. I'm going to start, I'm going to have my own organization. We're all going to start doing our own thing. God says, no, I don't want everybody doing what's right in their own eyes. This needs to be done proper. So Moses said to Korah and other sons of Levi that it's you who have gone too far. And the question I ask then for some to consider, have people gone too far today? Now, we might not all be in contact with some of those individuals, and I mentioned this before, being in the ministry gives me kind of a bigger perspective of what's happening throughout the wider Church of God around the world. But it is happening today that there are people that are giving in to this rebellion of Korah. So I hope that their fate is not going to be as dire. Like Moses, I don't want God to take these people out. You know, Moses was angry about the situation, and I think rightfully so, because it really affects the efforts of ministers in the church to try to do something for everybody that will help everyone when you have a bunch of people saying, no, we're going to be our own ministers. We're going to do our own thing. It really affects what we can do as a church of God as a whole. And so what do we have today? Some 100, 200 splinter groups? I don't know. Some say 400. I don't know who's keeping track. I just hear people throwing numbers out, but I don't know who's keeping track. It's too difficult to keep track of how many splinter groups are out there. It's sad. And frankly, dozens of those, if not possibly hundreds, they don't even have any ordained individuals involved. They just call themselves Church of God, whatever. The Bowling Church of God. You never know what you're going to hear nowadays. It's the rebellion of Korah is what it is. So it's true that Moses and Aaron were merely men. Isaiah was just a man. Noah, just a man. Deborah, who had to step in and get involved with the civil leadership of Israel, just a woman. These people were all just human beings. But what does just being human have to do with it? Really? Because God has always used people to do his work, to carry out his work on the earth. And so I've heard some use that expression in a disparaging manner when speaking of Herbert Armstrong, saying, he is just a man. Those truths were always there. Yeah, they were. But you didn't find them. They weren't revealed to you. They were revealed to him who taught others, who taught others, who taught others. And of course, we have learned even more unto this day as we are to continue to grow in grace and knowledge. And so every person that God has called to hold an office in the church or of others or among the people of Israel, they were just men, just people. That's really a disrespectful way of putting it, that they were just men. Because what you're trying to say is, they're no big deal. And the people who use such an argument, ask yourself this question, well, what are you then? Aren't you just a man? Aren't you just a woman? You know, the attempt to discredit the individual that has a position in the church is only an attempt to elevate themselves. I'm going to bring them down so I can bring myself up. It's pride. It's ego at work. That's the rebellion of Korah. And so, as Moses said to the rebels, the same is true today. What is Aaron that you complain against him? That's what he said to Korah and his men. What is he? He's just a man. Where is the rebellion really directed? He said, you've gathered together against God. Because that is God's ordained authority among the people. Korah and others, of course, they didn't see it that way. Many people out there might not see it this way today. But that is how God saw it. That is how he recorded it for us to remember. The enduring principle from Jude is to not put ourselves in a position of peril that's related to the rebellion of Korah. The failures of Israel, another point, was the failures of Israel were being blamed on a lack of proper guidance from Moses and Aaron. Now, some people will use the same argument today. They will say that the failures among the wider Church of God is because of the ministers. It's all their fault. Now, ministers have a part to play, and they are partly to blame. Some of them are largely to blame. That's true. And there's an example in this as to what happened to the house of Israel that were led astray. And I'm going to read some of this in Ezekiel 34 now. I think I had you turn there. Oh, I'm in Ezekiel 3, Ezekiel 34. And I'm going to read, a fair portion of this chapter, but let's just start off with the first 10 verses here. That the word of the Eternal came to the prophet Ezekiel, saying, Son of man, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel. So he's talking about the leadership. Some people might compare this to pastors or ministers. Prophesy and say to them, thus says the Eternal God of to the shepherds, woe to the shepherds of Israel who feed themselves. Should not the shepherds feed the flocks? You eat the fat and clothe yourselves with wool. You slaughter the fatlings, but you do not feed the flock. So in other words, we get the example. You're taking care of yourself, of your needs and your desires, but you're not taking care of those people that I put you in a position over to take care of them. The weak you have not strengthened, nor have you healed those who were sick, nor bound up the broken, nor brought back what was driven away, nor sought what was lost. But with force and cruelty you have ruled them. And so they were scattered because there was no shepherd, and they became food for all the beasts of the field when they were scattered. So he's talking about the nations that came in and invaded and took over first the northern kingdom and then the southern kingdom. My sheep wandered through all the mountains on every high hill. Yes, my flock was scattered over the whole face of the earth, and no one was seeking or searching for them. And therefore, you shepherds, hear the word of the Eternal. As I live, says the Eternal God, surely because my flock became a prey and my flock became food for every beast of the field, because there was no shepherd, nor did my shepherds search for my flock, but the shepherds fed themselves and did not feed my flock. Therefore, O shepherds, hear the word of the Eternal. Thus says the Eternal God, behold, I am against the shepherds, and I will require my flock at their hand. I will cause them to cease feeding the sheep, and the shepherds shall feed themselves no more. For I will deliver my flock from their mouths, that they may no longer be food for them. And so he's talking about bad shepherding. You could compare it to bad pastoring. You're not doing what you should do. You're not feeding the flock. You're not taking care of the weak. You're not edifying the people, getting them ready for Christ's return. You're just taking care of yourself. You're just taking care of your own wants, your own needs. And people are hurt out there. People are getting hurt. And they're becoming prey to those around them, environments around them, the sin around them. You're not taking care of them. And you're going to have to answer for it, like James said. Upon the teacher, stricter judgment is going to come upon those teachers, those ministers. And so there's the example for us. And God goes on to say in the next verses that he's going to gather his flock together. There's also a comparison in this. I'm making a comparison to the church. It's a right comparison. But there's also the comparison of the people of Israel, the tribes of Israel that were scattered. God is going to gather them once again. And so verse 11, for thus says the Eternal God, indeed, I myself will search for my sheep and seek them out. As a shepherd seeks out his flock on the day he is among his scattered sheep, so will I seek out my sheep and deliver them from all the places where they were scattered on a cloudy and dark day. And I will bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries, and I will bring them to their own land. I will feed them on the mountains of Israel, in the valleys, and in all the inhabited places of the country. So he's talking about specifically about the second Exodus here that's prophesied dozens of times in the scriptures. But there's this example here to people that were scattered because they were not well taken care of by the church, by ministers in the church. I will feed them in a good pasture, and their fold shall be on the high mountains of Israel. And there they shall lie down in a good fold and feed in rich pasture on the mountains of Israel. I will feed my flock, and I will make them lie down, says the Eternal God. I will seek what is lost, and will bring back what is driven away, bind up the broken, and strengthen what was sick. But I will destroy the fat and the strong, and feed them in judgment. So he's talking about the fat, meaning he's talking about people that appear to be well off, because they had taken from the flock. And as for you, he goes on to say, as we read the next verses, we are going to see that the flock is not entirely innocent. They're not all just innocent lambs. Verse 17 shows us that there are some, what we would call black sheep among the church. As for you, O my flock, thus says the Eternal God, behold, I shall judge between sheep and sheep, between rams and goats. Is it too little for you to have eaten the good pasture that you must tread down with your feet the residue of your pasture, and to have drunk the clear waters that you must foul the residue with your feet? So he's talking about people that were being fed good meat, spiritual food, truth, wisdom, things to make one wise, to help us in life. Is it too much that you take that and then you trample it down, you pollute it with your pet doctrines? You cloudy the waters that others are going to come to drink in? That's what's happening in the Church of God today. This is happening right now. People fouling the residue with their feet. And as for you, O my flock, they eat what you have trampled with your feet, and they drink what you have fouled with your feet. You're doing harm to others. Therefore, thus says the Eternal God to them, behold, I myself will judge between the fat and the lean sheep. Because you have pushed with side and shoulder, butted all the weak ones with your horns and scattered them abroad. You're playing rough here. You're roughhousing my people. You're not treating them nice. Therefore, I will save my flock, and they shall no longer be a prey, and I will judge between sheep and sheep. And so we see then the flock is not entirely innocent. Ministers that lead people astray are going to have to answer for it, and this has happened. There are brethren, lay members if you want to call it, sheep, leading people astray as well. So we have to be on guard. We have to prove all things. We have to hold fast to what is true. We can't give in to this rebellion of Korah that's happening out there. It's playing out once again. And so we see that the censers were gathered by the insurgents. They were fashioned into a covering for the altar of burnt offering. And they remain there as a reminder to future generations of what happened, that God is going to choose whom he will choose. And we have to live with that. We have to deal with that. It's not up to us to decide for ourselves. Again, we don't get to decide how we're going to apply God's law, just if. And God is saying, apply it. Here's how you apply it. He's not spelling it out for us. Let's make it simple. I'll just spell it out for you. So Paul said that if a man desires a ministerial position in the church, that it's a good work. And this is found in 1 Timothy 3. But there is a list of criteria that Paul gave, criteria that needs to be met. And the list talks about an individual being blameless, of being a husband of one wife, of having self-control, of being of sound mind, good behavior, hospitable, able to teach, not excessively drinking alcohol, not violent, not greedy, but being gentle, not argumentative, not covetous. A man who rules his own house well, it says having his children in submission with all reverence, and it says that he must have a good report among others. So how can we know if somebody has such qualifications unless they are evaluated by men who underwent such an evaluation themselves? This is how God chose to do it. I'm not making this stuff up. Some people that might be listening right now don't like what I'm saying. They don't want to hear it because they want to consider themselves to be in a position of a minister, that I should teach. I should be able to teach. Here's the qualifications. Have we gone through the proper channels is what I'm asking us. How do we know? It would be presumptuous and frankly very dangerous, as the example is given, for people to assume the responsibilities of a minister without the approval of their superiors. Sorry, that's how God designed it. We all have superiors. We all have somebody we have to answer to. Now, of course, some take the attitude of, I answer to no one but God. God is my only authority. But they'll use it as a justification to be a minister when they weren't ordained. They weren't really essentially called to be a minister. And they'll just say, well, I answer to God, and that's good enough. I don't need any elder to tell me what to do. That's the rebellion of Korah. It's not my example. God gave it to us. And so this kind of an attitude is really avoiding the real issue. What do you think the real issue might be? It really boils down to one of three things: lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and pride. I would say it's pride. It's ego. You know, there are people out there, frankly, there are some lay members in the Church of God that know more than some of the elders in the church. There are. And they'll say, I know more than the elder. I should be teaching. And they'll start their own group. They'll do their own thing. That's not your place. Just because you know more doesn't mean that, you know, you want to be a teacher in the church. What's wrong with going through the... Let me tell you what... Ask what the problem is of going through the proper channels. Why not have an elder involved? Are you worried that they might say, no, you know, you should just remain what you're doing? And, you know, you can speak on occasion and we'll do some stuff together, but I don't think you're ready to be ordained. Is that why you don't want to have elders involved? Because I think that is the case much of the time. There might be, of course, other factors, but my point is, it is the rebellion of Korah. And we live in a society where, frankly, think about it. We live in the land of the free, right? Liberty. That's what we are familiar with. And that is a good thing. Liberty is a good thing, but liberty has taken a wrong turn today, hasn't it? Liberty has become a license to sin. Freedom to a growing minority means free from any kind of moral restraints. There are groups of people out there that are violently promoting anarchy. There are people out there that are calling parents who want a good and decent education for their children, they're calling them extremists, and they're using government money to pay for such ads. Just saw it last night. That's why it comes to mind. The concept of doing whatever is right in your own eyes is not new. It goes all the way back. We saw it happening among the people of Israel. God was against it then, and God remains against it today. And there's a need for us to have positions of authority in the church. Just as there was a need for prophets, there's a need for elders, there is a need for priests in the temple. As the Apostle Paul had said this, and this is something that we always need to keep in mind, he told those people whom he taught, imitate me as I imitate Christ. You could say, follow me as I follow Christ. And if an individual is not following Christ, don't follow that. But if they are, why wouldn't we want to follow that? Why wouldn't we want to be a part of that? You know, it really comes down again, ego. It's ego. So James said that stricter judgment would be upon those who are called to teach. And the same kind of judgment is going to call upon those who are not called to teach, but are choosing to teach anyway. And when we consider everything that's going on, I know the Church of God is a mess. It really is a mess. And it's sad, and I'm sorry. I wish it were not like this. I wish there were not so many groups out there all doing their own thing. I wish we could have more unity and effort in the works that we are doing. And we have actually reached out, and others have reached out to us to do some shared services and some shared events in the past. And we have done that, and we will continue to do that. But there are legitimate ministers in the Church of God today. There are people, elders in the Church of God, that we should listen to. And we should want to be a part of that. We should want to be a part of what the Church of God is doing that is positive and helpful to us and also to others. If we do not want to be a part of that and we want to just do our own thing, it's the rebellion of Korah. God showed us how he felt about it then, and as it says about God, he does not change. He feels the same about it today. He's not going to change just because, well, circumstances are different, so it's okay to have rebellion against my ministers today. The Church of God is not in a good place. And there are many people that are meeting with various groups that do not have any kind of ordained authority over them, and many of them don't want any kind of authority over them. They want to, as they say, do their own thing. But I ask us to consider, as we conclude here, because I've probably drawn this out longer than I should have, but it's an important message, and it's something that we haven't really spoke on directly, except for in recent months. We've kind of mentioned some of this in brief over the years, but this is something that I really hope hits home to us, that instead of adding to the division that's going on in the wider Church of God, why don't we try to be a part of the unification of the Church of God? Why don't we try to support the work of the Church of God? Why don't we try to help our brethren in Christ? Why don't we try to help support the ministers that are doing things that are positive and helpful? Because none of us, ordained or not, none of us get to choose how to apply God's law. Only if. That's spelled out for us in the Bible. So let's not just say that we love others, that we love God. Let's show it. Because faith without works is dead. We're not showing that how we love God and how we love others. It's no faith at all, according to James. So let's fulfill our duty by doing what we can to help brethren, to support the work of the church, and to reach out to those organizations that are striving to be faithful, because there are people out there trying to be faithful. And I ask us to not associate with those groups who Jude says perish in the rebellion of Korah.